Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us for the first half of the show today is Bren Smith, and he's the author of Eat Like a Fish, My Adventures as a Fisherman Turned Restorative Ocean Farmer. So, Bren, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun to call into a landlocked state. It doesn't happen much.
That's great. So did we pull you off the farm this morning out of the boat?
It's high winds and big weather today, so no.
Oh, good. Oh, good. Well, we're glad.
That's interesting. One of your challenges. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
So, Bren, you, as we mentioned in our introduction, you're a restorative ocean farmer, and we'll get into what that means. But you haven't always been. Your kind of previous career was as a commercial fisherman. So tell us a little bit about how you kind of chose that profession and how you eventually ended up moving away from it.
Yeah, so I was born up in Newfoundland, Canada. Yeah, outboard kid, a village called Maddox Cove, in the most eastern point in all of North America. And it was like, fisherman's co-op, and kids were selling cod tongues door to door. It was just this idyllic life. And my heroes weren't cowboys or astronauts. They were fishermen. And I'd see them go out in the horizon every morning, and it just looked freaking awesome because, they owned their own boats. They didn't have bosses. They lived self-directed lives, and they were the last wild hunters, and they got to feed the community. They had this incredible sense of meaning. And I think as I've gotten older, I realized that's what I wanted to retain, that identity, whether it's farmers, coal workers, steel workers, the people that power, build, and feed the country. There's just incredible meaning that comes out, sort of jobs that you can write songs about and sing songs about, and that's that's always been the goal.
The life of a commercial fisherman, though, is not necessarily an easy one. It's not what we think of as a cushy job, despite its independence.
No, I dropped out of high school when I was 14 and headed out to sea. I fished Grand Banks, George's Banks, and then headed out in Alaska. And it's at that point, it was in the 80s, the most dangerous profession out there, but I loved it, being in 40-foot seas and at sea at 3 months at a time. There was just nothing like it. But the sad thing is that eventually the cod stocks crashed back in Newfoundland where I was from, and that was sort of the real wake-up call that there was no way I was going to be a fisherman if we didn't figure out how to protect the oceans and protect resources. Because I'm not an environmentalist. I don't think about birds and bees much, but I do believe that unless we protect our oceans, unless we protect our climate, there are going to be no jobs on a dead planet. Environmental issues are actually economic issues for most of us that work for a living.
Well, specifically, what were you observing in these conditions? Basically, over-extraction?
Yeah, what happened was that after World War II, the naval fleets got redirected into the private sector, into the fishing industry. So, and it just scaled harvesting beyond belief. Even the pilots got reassigned to be spotter planes to chase schools of fish around the globe. And we just, we were too good at what we did.
Right.
We pillaged the ocean. So I was seeing, entire ecosystems ripped up by trawls, dead bycatch. One out of three fish we would come up dead that we couldn't we couldn't sell. And so it was just, and most of the fish I was catching was going to McDonald's. Now I still love my McDonald's fish sandwich, but this was the most unsustainable form of food, harvesting the world, producing some of the lowest least healthy food on the planet.
So what does that journey look like after you kind of change your mind about commercial fishing? It's not as rewarding for you anymore. How do you get from there to owning a 20-acre farm and doing this incredible restorative ocean farming?
Yeah, it was when I left the Bering Sea, I ended up on the salmon farms doing aquaculture because, my generation, we were told, okay, that was going to be the answer to overfishing, job creation, feed the planet. But salmon farming was just not the answer. It was feedlots, pollution, using pesticides, antibiotics, escapes. It was just not a sustainable way to produce food, and certainly not to feed the feed people. I mean, what aquaculture traditionally done is grow what people want to eat. So they've always eaten salmon and tunas and cod, things like that, and those disappear, so then we try to grow them. And I think that's not the journey we need to take. But when I left the salmon farms disillusioned, I ended up in Long Island Sound, chased a woman down there, ended up, and had to find my way back onto the water. And that wasn't easy, but eventually I remade myself as an oysterman. And that was that big shift from hunter-gatherer to farmer. And I was a terrible farmer. I mean, so bad. I killed millions of oysters the first couple of years because I didn't have a blue thumb. I had no idea how to grow things. And it was incredibly boring, right? You know, fishing, you never know what's going to come up. I always knew it was going to be oysters, right? So I was becoming more of an arugula farmer, having to like drink tea. I couldn't go to the same bars I used to as a fisherman. and that was a real sort of psychological shift. But over time, I learned from my oysters that, you know, there was a profession to be had out there. If we ask the oceans what to grow, we can create real jobs and real opportunity. And when you ask the ocean that, they say pretty simply, why don't you grow things you don't have to feed and won't swim away? Right? And that's simple. So all of our shellfish just, you know, they just eat what's in the water. They nitrogen, carbon, things like that. Our seaweeds just soak up sunlight and grow naturally. And it's just a really simple way to farm. You just go and make sure your crops are at the right level of the water column and just sit back and watch it happen. So no nets, no pens, no feed, nothing.
Yeah, so you were using actually land-based terms of farming to describe what you're doing out on the Long Island Sound. Even the fact that this is a 20-acre plot, correct?
Yes.
How do you acquire 20 acres of water? What is the legal aspects of doing that?
Yeah, that's a great question because it really is weird. And in fact, those of farming and water, we're still looking for the right language, right? Because we're sort of stuck between two worlds. But the way it happens here is you lease, and you lease either from the town, the state, or the federal government, depending on where it is and how far out in the ocean it is. But we don't own that water. What we own is the right to grow shellfish and seaweed. Hmm. Anybody can use it for any other use. They can boat, they can fish, they can swim through it. So we're still protecting the commons. People just can't grow seaweeds and shellfish there. So it's more of almost like a process right rather than a property right. What's great about it, you know, my lease is only $50 an acre per year. Really affordable. And we're rebuilding ecosystems. So, you know, our farms function as these artificial reefs. So rather than a privatized space, it's just this sort of community garden that people can come and enjoy locally.
I read that the areas around your farms, your artificial reef, are excellent places for fishing, for locals to come fish.
Exactly, because, you know, for here, just on the East Coast, the equivalent of the coral reefs were oyster reefs. They were so big you had to navigate your boats through them back 200 years ago, 100 years ago. Those are all gone now. There's really just a lot of mud. And so as we rebuild and use that whole water column and growing all these species, the fish come to eat, to hide, to thrive. There's ducks, there's seals, there's all sorts of stuff. And so both gill netters, as commercial fishermen and recreational fishers, they know where the fish are, and it's on the farm at this point.
So give us an idea of, like, what the farm looks like underwater. Like, what kind of infrastructure do you have there, and what are you growing?
Yeah. So in some ways, I'm the worst person to say this because I don't swim. Like most northern fishermen, I've never learned to swim, but I think I can, you know, let's paint a picture together of people that tell me what it looks like underwater. But it's like an underwater garden or just a rope scaffolding system. So you've got anchors at the edges of the farm and then ropes up to the surface with buoys and then horizontal ropes down across, you know, about 8 feet below the surface. And from there, we grow our kelp vertically downwards. We've got mussels and something we call mussel socks, which look like big sausages, basically. We've got scallops and lantern nets, and then oysters and cages down below, and then clams in the mud. And just, you know, you take 20 acres and you try to figure out all the different things you can grow. It's polyculture of the ocean. And in many ways, what we're doing is taking a lot of the lessons that, you know, farmers in your state have been developing for, you know, hundreds of years, and we're just trying to figure out as infants how to farm the ocean in a really diverse diverse way. So I do a lot of stealing from land-based farmers.
And a lot of the plants and animals that you're growing are indigenous, right? Indigenous to that area. Yeah. They're not things that you're bringing in.
Yeah. I mean, we work in we've trained and supported our nonprofit, which trains and supports ocean farmers at this point. We have 50 farms around the country. And you have to grow native species as part of the program. And so I only grow things that are local. The amazing thing is there are 10,000 plants in the ocean, hundreds of kinds of shellfish. Thousands of them are edible. So there is something we can grow everywhere using just a very simple farming system. One of the things we like is that because we don't have to feed, we don't have to water, we don't have to fertilize our crops, making it the most sustainable food on the planet, hands down, it's just so cheap and replicable. You only need anywhere from $20,000 to $30,000 a boat and a lease to start your own farm and be up and running the first year. It's so unlike the really expensive sort of land-based farming model. So we have a lot of young land-based farmers coming to us to start farms because it's just it's cheaper, it's easier, just generally more affordable.
And even at that kind of small-ish scale, it's still economically viable to be an ocean farmer?
Yeah, and mainly because the overhead's so low, because you don't have those inputs that are really costly. I mean, fish feed is the most expensive input on a fish farm. So because it's cheap, we're just using the natural nutrients. It's very much so. I mean, in 25 acres, you're growing up to 10 tons of seaweed per acre, 250,000 shellfish. So you can, it's really $90,000 to $120,000 you're netting. You create a bunch of jobs. This is very viable. That said, it has to be the right patch of water. So we can't augment our soil, right? We can't take and put fertilizers in like that. Our soil turns over 1,000 times a day. We don't have control of that. So some places we farm, we put in a couple lines and we find out that crops don't grow. So then that's not a viable farm. But we have farms in everything from 4 feet of water in New York State to 600 feet of water in Alaska. So there are just a lot of places we can put these. And, I'm not really an environmentalist per se. These have to be viable businesses, they've got to create jobs, but while also reviving the ocean and, helping address climate change.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Brent Smith. He's a former commercial fisherman turned ocean farmer who helped pioneer the development of something called restorative 3D ocean farming. And he's also the author of a new book titled Eat Like a Fish, My Adventures as a Fisherman Turned Restorative Ocean Farmer. So, Bryn, you talked about a lot of the upsides. Let's talk about some of the challenges, let's say, of ocean farming in this way. Like today, you say it's heavy weather, so you're limited or restricted to what you can do out on the water. What about other, let's say, unintended consequences of working on the Long Island Sound, which includes water quality, perhaps? Yep. Could be an issue?
No, absolutely. I mean, again, because we can't control our water, the water flow, we really have to make sure where we grow is traceable, is really, very viable to produce food. And so we have things that we call, they're food farms, but also pollution farms in other areas. So we're farming in New York and San Diego Harbor, just as pollution farms to soak up heavy metals, nitrogen, things like that, and rebuild the reef. So those do not enter the food system. And then other places, the great thing about seaweed and shellfish is the most traceable food in the planet when it's farmed in the U.S. because shellfish is a dangerous, if it's toxic, it can, of course you can get sick.
Right.
So, you wish your arugulas and tomatoes were as traceable as our shellfish and seaweed. So that's key, sort of good, strong, traceable regulation. That's key. Another thing is our industry is so young that a lot of the infrastructure isn't there yet, right? Where states have invested and really supported those land-based processing plants, things like that, it's been great. But, in the water, it's really cheap to grow this stuff. As soon as you hit land, you hit all the challenges that land-based farmers face. Where I'm hopeful on this, the other piece is the market development. Seaweed, I I would never traditionally eat it, thought it was disgusting. So how do we move it to the center of the plate and really shift markets so that, you know, there's enough demand? I think one of my hopes, not only, you know, we got recipes in the book, we worked with incredible chefs, and a lot of the corporate cafeterias are buying it, and we've really figured out how to de-sushify, I think, seaweeds. But it doesn't have to just be food. It's sort of like soy of the sea, right? The soy industry sat down in the 50s and said, okay, we're never going to get American seed soy, so we'll put it in everything. And now soy is everywhere.
Right.
And so our seaweeds can be used as fertilizer. We use it on farms all the time. Farmers have been using this forever because it's packed full of nutrients. Seaweeds, if you feed cattle a 2% diet of Asparagopsis, the type of seaweed, you get a 58% reduction in methane output. We use it. We can use it as bioplastics. The London Marathon just had their first kelp seaweed water bottles. So there are all these different uses, and that's what gives me real hope that this isn't just about shifting taste, which we are doing, but that can be slow, and we need to move, move the market more quickly.
Well, let's dig into the food side of this, because I think that's an interesting piece of it. You said that, you know, you were even kind of skeptical, like, are people going to eat these things, seaweed, you know, and maybe any other place than sushi. So talk a little bit about your experience in that area.
Yeah, so when I was doing the book especially, I just discovered this whole lost Western culinary history of seaweeds, or sea greens, like we like to call them. So seaweed was a standard bar snack in Irish and Scottish bars. Italians used to turn them into fritters, fermented them as with like lemon juice and vinegars. First Nations folks ate them all the time as they smoked them and smeared them in fat, and ate them with shellfish. And the industry was quite large. In the early 1900s, there were 1,500 workers producing 52 different kelp products on the ports of San Diego.
Wow.
Like, it's just stunning. And those included feed and fertilizer. So we think of seaweed as Asian, but in fact, if you look around the globe, everywhere there have been people living on the coast, seaweed was a core thing for roofing, for insulation, for food. So that was a fascinating journey for me. One of the things, as you farm more, and I'm sure your land-based farmers understand this, is like there's terroir on land. So, you know, everywhere you grow, things taste a bit different. It's like the wines. Well, same for us.
Right.
Everywhere we're growing, we get marroir, different flavors. So I grow a sugar kelp in its southern region, which makes it more delicate, thinner. It's still got like an al dente crunch, but it's just not what you think of as big, thick seaweed, and that's really useful because I can market to certain areas. So as we farm more of those, the complexity of the crops, and then, you know, with thousands of edible plants, imagine being a chef and finding there were, you know, kales, arugulas, tomatoes that you've never seen with, let alone cooked with before. It means that this can kind of be a very inventive, creative space. And the last thing I'd say is I started out with this thinking of seaweed as seafood, and I worked with seafood chefs, and that was not the right way. They kept on wrapping seaweed around fish and creating seaweed salads, essentially copying Asian cuisine.
Right.
Then I gave it to a guy named Brooks Headley in New York who specializes in making vegetables unhealthy so that people eat them. And he took the kelp noodles, right? It's brilliant, right? He used to be a punk rock drummer and was a pastry chef at Del Posto, and he now runs the Superiority Burger. But he took the kelp noodles and did barbecue kelp noodles with parsnips and breadcrumbs. Absolutely delicious, right? The heat, the roundness of the parsnips, the crunchiness of the breadcrumbs, and it just totally takes it out of that sushi category and moves it somewhere else. So this is a creative moment for chefs. We have all these great recipes done by these chefs in the book, which really works to sort of make it a delicious cuisine rather than being, you know, just because it's good for the planet doesn't mean we want to eat, you know, being force-fed cod liver oil, essentially.
Well, I can't help think about how things like this need a market makeover, because you think of Patagonian toothfish. No one really wanted to eat a Patagonian toothfish until it suddenly became a Chilean sea bass. And then suddenly, it was, so this is no longer seaweed. This is not a weed.
Yeah.
This is a grass or
sea greens.
This is a sea green or sea lettuce or something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah, you have to. And of course, Bryn, if you barbecue anything, Americans will eat it. Right?
Throw it on the grill.
Right. Right.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, the blended burger is funny because so McDonald's had a seaweed burger in the early 90s. And it became the national burger of the National Basketball Association. Wow. Like, it's so weird, these little bits of history that are there.
What?
And now blended burgers are the hottest thing. And, you know, using seaweed and along with peas and mushrooms and stuff they're already using is, you know, this is the time.
So, Bryn, are there people out there that are, like, specializing in kind of discovering and testing out some of these new, I guess, vegetables that are in the sea that, you know, these greens are... things that you can eat?
Yeah, there. It's interesting. There's just been this explosion of entrepreneurs, chefs, and scientists, and nutritionists that are coming together to do this. And there's some great companies like Barnacle Seafoods up in Alaska. There's Akua here in New York. They do a kelp jerky, but they've got these products. But behind the scene, they're just digging into all these different seaweeds and flavors. What's interesting is the other sector that's really doing a lot with it is the pet food industry, because they've done a nutritional analysis, one company, of 250 different kinds of seaweed, because they're so worried about the cost of pet food going up. And they know that any crop that's zero input is going to be really affordable, things that don't use water, things like that. So it's just surprising that, you know, although it does make sense because, you know, people now feed their pets better than they feed their babies.
Yeah.
So I figure.
Sure.
So there probably is room for innovation there.
So what about the supply side? It sounds like the demand is growing pretty rapidly, but, you know, are there people interested in starting out these relatively small, you know, maybe 20-acre farms? And also, how do you keep them from becoming the big, giant, massive monoculture farms that we see on land?
Yeah, exactly. This was just me, a petri dish, experimenting, trying to figure out a way to stay working on the water, right? I want to die on my boat one day, and this is all it was. And if I meant I had to grow as something embarrassing as seaweed, I was going to do it, right? it's really taken off. And we now have, our nonprofit now has 4,000 requests to start farms in every coastal state in North America and 20 countries around the world. It's just crazy. And we, you know, there's no way we can meet that demand. But the interest is really there. That sort of 20 acres of boat, $20,000-$30,000 to start your own farm, I think make people feel like it's really possible and they can do something to help feed their communities and participate in, you know, climate solutions. So that's really taken off. Training is, we've got two pieces. The training was fascinating because land-based farmers who came out and started farming, they were really great at growing. They were great at cultivating, but no boating skills. They were, you know, what I thought was just usual weather. They were petrified, you know, snowing out there. They got to break ice, and they won't go out. And I'm like, what? This is just normal fishing, right? Fishing weather. But then the fishermen go out, and they start farming, and they're great with marine skills, but they're terrible farmers like I was. They, like, rip the seaweed off. They stamp all over it. They just really want it off the boat. And so the training has had this sort of cultural nuance to it to take people that are from all different walks of life. One of the most fascinating things is 2 years ago, GreenWave stepped back and looked at who's it coming into the industry. Who are the farmers? Who are the hatchery techs? Who are the entrepreneurs creating value-added products? Majority women. Huge shock, right? I thought it was going to be all crusty fishermen like me, but women are flooding in. And the prospect of this being one of the first industries where women are the architects of it, fascinating. Like, there's Catherine Puckett in Rhode Island. She grows oysters, clams, and kelp. Multi-species. She's got a pink boat, all male crew. They like it because they don't have to leave island in off-season because it's a summer, summer island. So they love their job, but they hate working on a pink boat. Right? But maybe this is the future, like fleets of pink boats and women as the captains, you know, me working the deck.
We just have another minute or two. Talk a little more about your nonprofit, GreenWave.
Yeah. So it's we're working in 7 different states right now. We're growing pretty rapidly. Great team of folks that work on permitting. So, you know, farmers come into the program, they get permitting. We help them set up farms. They get free seed. They get a whole suite of services. But we're also doing an online toolkit so that people can start their own farms. So within the next 6 months, we'll be rolling out tools. So any of you who want to move to the coast and start farms, visit greenway.org, and hopefully we'll have the tools there so folks can get started and don't need us.
Fantastic. And so if people are interested in learning more about the book, where can they find it and learn more about you online?
Yeah, so you get the book on Amazon or your local bookstore, Eat Like a Fish, and that has instructions how to start a farm, my whole personal story, and sort of the future of this and why we think it's a powerful solution.
Well, fantastic. That was Bren Smith, author of Eat Like a Fish, My Adventures as a Fisherman Turned Restorative Ocean Farmer. And I have to say, it's a great read. So, yeah. Bren, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much. Honor to be on.
Thanks, Bren.
All right.
All right. Bye-bye.